Okay, today we're going to talk about objects, right? Now, so far in your various lectures, you've heard about the novel form being about the rise of the self. You've heard about the novel form being about, in many ways, concerned with gender, etc. One of the things I want to add to the mix here is ask you to consider the novel form as the first really concentrated narrative form that takes material things seriously. Okay? By seriously, I don't mean that previous narrative forms, such as, let us say, the Romance, did not take objects seriously, but what I mean is that the order of their meaning or the signification of those objects used to be different, right? So let us say in prose romance of the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, we do find detailed attention being paid to, I don't know, the knight's shield, for example, or his lance, or the beautiful lady's dress, etc. But they were tied to an order of meaning that we might call transcendental, right? They tried to look at what those things meant in the light of a set of meanings that transcended their materiality. So the shield or the lance were more than the shield or the lance, or the flower motifs on the dress means more than just the flower motifs of the dress. They're tied to a kind of order of meaning that has both divine but also noble connotations about what it means to be nobility in a world of flux, etc. Now, when we come to the age of the novel, and this is a very long age we are talking about, there are a couple of things that strike us. One is the details about objects, everyday objects that the characters are using, etc., they proliferate. Okay? This doesn't happen all at once. For example, when we look at Goethe's Werther and then go to Emma in Austin, one of the things we immediately see is Austin's Emma has more invested in the objects that surround Emma's everyday life than, let us say, Werther in Goethe. So it's not all happening at once. Nonetheless, the relationship between the material existence of daily objects and the characters, that becomes slowly one of the central points of the novel form. So one of the things I want to do today is ask you to consider how the novel portrays, because we've heard about the novel being a secular, the prose form per excellence of a secular age, the novel being the prose form per excellence of the age of the individual. One of the things I want us to think about today is how these things, such as the self or the idea of a secular world, arrive at us through the novel form's consideration of the relationship between everyday banal objects and the characters in the novel. So what we're talking about really is the lives of things. And I'm going to talk a little bit, I'll go back and forth between a few novels. I'll talk a little bit about Austin, as well as look at Madame Bovary, Flaubert's Madame Bovary, and Charles Dickens's Great Expectations in more details. But I'll kind of range over those texts. Let's start by looking at one of the things we've already talked about in Emma briefly, which might be summarized as the relationship between propriety, desire, and property. And the first extract kind of outlines what I mean by that, okay? So one of the ways of reading Emma is to see how propriety, proper conduct, Jill was talking about the novel of sensibility as opposed to the novel of the self. So proper conduct becomes something that Emma has to learn via her conversations with Mr. Knightley, for example. so that the erotic desire that circulates through the novel, not only Emma's, but other people's as well, are properly channeled and social stability maintained. So one of the things we talked about in Emma is this idea of the relationship between propriety, property, and desire. So if you look at that first extract, this is Emma looking at Donwell Abbey, Mr. Knightley's property. At this point, she's unaware of her own desire for Mr. Knightley. The novel hasn't told us that this is how it's all going to end, although there have been hints dropped on the web. But look at the language here. It was so long since Emma had been at the Abbey that as soon as she was satisfied of her father's comfort, she was glad to leave him and look around her. So this is Emma gazing out at Donwell Abbey. She felt all the honest pride and complacency. It's an interesting choice of word, complacency. Because Emma, at this point, except for her connection with Mr. Knightley and the Knightley family, doesn't own the property as such. So the idea of complacency is an interesting one here, which her alliance with the present and future proprietor could fairly warrant. As she viewed the respectable, and then we get the detail of the property, as she viewed the respectable size and style of the building, its suitable, becoming characteristic situation, low and sheltered, its ample garden. So notice the words here, suitable, becoming, low, sheltered, ample, etc., ending with the abundance of timber in rows and avenues, which neither fashion nor extravagance had rooted up. So here you have an idea of a central character of the novel gazing out at material things, timber, the house, the grounds of the house, etc. What she's unaware of at this point is how much she desires this cornucopia of objects via the current owner of this property, Mr. Knightley, and that is something that the novel will teach her later on, i.e. her desire will flow along the circuits both of property, Donwell Abbey, and propriety, how her emotions should be suitably matched to Mr. Knightley. She's not aware of this yet, but this is one of the ways the novel drops hints as what will happen if the novel is to end properly, okay? Contrast that to a passage in Madame Bovary quite early on. This is Charles Bovary. Remember, he's a son of a fairly driven father, and he is a medical student at this point. He's working very, very hard, apparently to no avail. All his work is not translating into high grades, right? This is what happens to him in his career as a medical student. He formed the habit of frequenting bars and developed a passion for dominoes. To sit of an evening cooped up in a grubby public room for the sole purpose of stacking little oblongs of sheep's bones marked with black dots on a marble-topped table seemed to him now to be a significant gesture of freedom. Okay, so pay attention to the word freedom. Something which raised him in his own estimation. He grew to regard it as a ritual of initiation into the great world, and then the key words, as the key to forbidden pleasure. Now, like Emma, here too you have a central character, although arguably not as central as Emma Bovary, but a central character who is looking at objects with pleasure, with desire. But note the differences between this object and what Emma was looking out at. These are dominoes, i.e. they're chips in a gambling game. The novel gives us very detailed descriptions of those, and you can see how Charles' own idea of pleasure is gradually tied up with these objects. But these objects do not signify the stability of landed property, right? What do they signify? They signify gambling, the very opposite of propriety. And Charles is sitting here, and his pleasure is roving around in a circuit that's, in some ways, the polar opposite of Emma's. Of Austin's Emma's. So what you see here are two ideas of desire, objects, and propriety. In one, desire circulates around an idea of this ample, beautiful, sheltered house and gardens. And the comic resolution of the novel finally brings together Emma with her object of desire. And by the end of the novel, remember, one of the things Austin tells us that by the end, Emma is totally untroubled. In the beginning, she had said, "Oh no, Mr. Knightley can never get married because what will happen to his nephew who stands in line to inherit that property?" By the end of the novel, she's not really remotely bothered about what's happened to the nephew. She's quite happy that she's the mistress of Donwell Abbey. Opposite to that, you have Charles' only sole source of pleasure, at this point tied to an idea of, if you like, improper desire of gambling. And one of the things that Madame Bovary, as a novel, asks us to consider is this idea of indebtedness. What happens when you gamble away your life? Not just in terms of monetary terms, but also in terms of your own emotion, sexuality, etc. So you have two different perspectives on the relationship between human beings and apparently banal objects that surround them. One of the things we have to ask ourselves is, if they are indeed banal, why does the novel form invest so much into giving us a detailed description of what people feel when they look at objects that surround them? Okay, so therein is a clue about what the novel is asking you to do, to consider what happens when it is a worldly form, i.e. it is invested in looking at how people, men and women, form their relationships, not just regarding other men and women around them, but through the objects that come in between them and the others, such as the dominoes, such as houses, etc. So if the novel is a worldly form and it gives us the world in solid, perceptible reality, and that's part of the reason why it sketches out these objects in details, it also asks us to consider what happens when people are tied together, not through transcendental ideas about heroism, nobility, divinity, etc., but what happens when people come together through an idea of objects that link them. Okay, so what we're talking about is social relations being mediated through objects. And this is the predicament of all these characters. They yearn for something higher, larger, more noble, more satisfying. Their problem is that they can't relate to each other without these objects, day-to-day objects that surround them. I.e., they've lost that connection, it seems. Remember Werther's dissatisfaction with his life and Emma's and so on, every character you meet. What they have lost is this idea of there lies something beyond the material world that they might then appeal to for their own satisfaction. They can only relate to each other via these things. Okay. So those are the kind of two different aspects or different representation of this same problem. And one of the things that we'll see as we proceed through the various novels are how different authors represent this particular problem to us. Okay, let's look at a scene where you'll find various of your characters, a kind of setting, physical setting, where various of your novelistic characters frequent, i.e. that of a shop. Okay, if churches in the age of nobility, if churches and castles were the typical physical spaces where the exchange of relationship between human beings occurred, again, I'm thinking of prose romances here, the shop becomes one of the sites par excellence of the age of the novel, where people quite unconsciously find themselves either browsing or shopping, or then considering what those actions mean for themselves and their fellow beings. Shopping also, of course, raises the specter of what you're buying, what you're buying those commodities with, and what that means to you. So again, two contrasting scenes here. Madame Bovary first. This time, Emma is not in a shop, but the shop, as it were, has come to Emma, right? Okay. So this is Monsieur Leroux. A poor shop like his, Leroux is here trying to entice Emma into buying his stuff. It's not calculated to appeal to a lady of fashion, he dwelt on the word. But she had only to express her wishes, and he would undertake to get her anything she wanted, silks or linen, stockings or fancy goods. With great dexterity, Monsieur Leroux proceeded to exhibit 3 Algerian scarves, several packets of English needles, a pair of straw slippers, and to crown it all, 4 egg cubs carved from coconut shells in filigree by convicts. Every now and again, as though to remove a speck of dust, he gave a flick with his fingernail to the silk of the scarves, which were displayed at full length. When he did this, they quivered with a faint rustling sound, and the gold spangles woven into their tissues gleamed in the evening light like stars. So 2 things immediately strike us: the amount of narrative energy invested in describing these objects, and without telling us this, we already know the attraction these objects will have for Emma. This is a woman starved of any sensations, bored, as she says again and again, always trying to simulate what she has read of in romances and in other kinds of lowly literature. We'll come to that in a second. And thinks that her life should always be more full of sensations than it is. Now, the glimmer and the texture of these objects, immediately we know when we read it, this is going to be irresistible to Emma. So what you see here is a scene of shopping that immediately triggers various key themes in the novel. Is Emma going to be able to resist the allure of these objects to fulfill her otherwise barren lives? If not, what kind of debt will she get into? And we will see what consequences that debt has for Emma, both emotionally and physically, by the end of the novel. But the question of indebtedness, remember, Leroux says, don't worry, just express your wish and I'll get you whatever you want. Don't worry about money at this point. Of course, all the while thinking just the opposite. How shall I entrap this woman who appears to be so gullible, etc. So you have one version of debt or indebtedness that the novel gives us, intimately connected to the lack in Emma's life. Why does Emma get into this kind of debt? We're not told explicitly, but through the representation of these glimmering objects, we are given a hint of how irresistible they are going to be to a character such as Emma. The debt, of course, is going to be a monetized debt, i.e. Emma is going to be in monetary debt to Leroux, which he'll try and claim back later, leading to the catastrophe in the novel. Okay, so that's one kind of relationship between characters and things that the novel is trying to alert us to. How do people develop this idea of being in debt to other people who are pushing, who are providing them with commodities or material objects? Another shopping scene arrives to us in Great Expectations with a different kind of tonal register. This is Pip, who has walked into the shop of Mr. Pumblechook. Mr. Pumblechook's premises in the high street of the market town were of a peppercorny and farinaceous character, as the premises of corn chandler and seedsman should be. It appeared to me that he must be a very happy man indeed to have so many little drawers in his shop, and I wondered when I peeped into one or two on the lower tiers and saw the tied up brown paper packets inside, whether the flowers and seeds and bulbs ever wanted off on a fine day to break out of those jails. Another shopping scene, another display of commodities. Rather, these commodities are hidden at this point in time. Pip goes in apparently admiring this whole plethora of things, but notice what he arrives at by the end, the sense he arrives at the end, whether these seeds and bulbs have ever wanted on a fine day to break out of those jails. Okay? Another sense of confinement, of being hemmed in, but this time, unlike in Emma Bovary, Pip's reaction to the things already alert us to a different relationship with things and the idea of being in debt. Remember, the title of the novel is Great Expectations. What is Pip expecting? Pip is expecting to become a gentleman. He mistakenly assumes that one of his benefactors is sending him to London to become a gentleman, and a lot of the novel will turn on that mistake. Actually, he's in debt to someone else entirely, whose source of wealth we are encouraged to view with, if not suspicion, with a critical distance. Magwitch has made his fortune in Australia, and he's sponsoring Pip without him knowing it, right? So the whole idea of gentlemanliness, becoming a gentleman in, for Pip, it turns on this mistake of who his benefactor is. But remember, by the end of the novel, he can only become gentlemanly when he loses this source of wealth and property, etc. I.e., he can only become, his great expectations are only fulfilled when he is actually breaks out of the structure of indebtedness. The wealth that he is supposed to inherit never actually materializes. He has to go to the East to make his own fortune, etc. So, two different relationships with objects. Emma is helpless already in front of the gleam of these things. Pip immediately has viewed this with suspicion, the shop with suspicion. Although the details are there and he thinks it's a magical shop, he also thinks, what about those objects inside these drawers? On a fine day, do they not want to break out of their prison? Now, this is clearly not a complimentary, entirely complimentary way of looking at Mr. Pumblechook's treasure. So already, although Pip doesn't tell us this, we know he has a more critical relationship with the glimmer of things that surround him. Okay? So if indebtedness or debt is one of the frames we employ to see the relationship between characters, the characters in different novels are also situated differently to the idea of debt and relationship of the objects through which they relate to each other. Okay, now, so far, what I have said is the novel as a form is heavily interested in the idea of the relationship between human desires, wants, etc., and the objects that surround them. And this is a mark of the novel as a form, or as a narrative form of a rapidly secularizing age, okay? As an age that is gradually re-examining what it held to be its deepest norms. The second point I've suggested to you is, alongside the consideration of the relationship of these things to the characters, the novel asks us to consider this: what does it mean to be indebted? In an age, in the 18th and 19th centuries, when the question of being in debt is a burning one, not just personal debt, but what happens when societies are in debt to each other, etc. In that age, the novel asks us, how do characters understand what they owe to other characters via their relationship with the things that link them to other characters? So Emma and LaRue, they have a particular relationship, whereas Pip and Pumblechook, or later Pip and Magwitch, they'll have a particular relationship through the objects or the kind of wealth or the lack thereof that brings them together. Now, this is a general source of, if not anxiety, or source of fascination in 19th century, and several key 19th century thinkers try and theorize what the relationship between material objects and human beings actually are. And I've just given you a kind of a selection of those. I won't go through them. The first two are Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud. Now, both of them, in fact, all three in that middle section, offer two key ways of thinking about the relationship between objects and characters. First, all of them talk about mystification. Objects are mysterious. Why are they mysterious? For Marx, because they do not tell us. When you pick up, I don't know, your iPad, it doesn't tell you who built the iPad and how much time and labor went into it. So it appears to us as a shiny object already made, but it hides its real origins. That's kind of, I'm doing a crude summary here, but that's kind of what Marx talks about when he talks about the mystery of commodities. Commodities do not tell us. They offer us a vision of consumption that hide the source of, or the way of its production for them. So it offers us a view that hides what it really is, and hence it's mysterious. So when you look at commodities, they don't tell you immediately the real relationship between it and you as someone who's buying that commodity. So that's Marx. Freud says, partly as a result of this mystery of commodities and things in 19th century, one of the central feelings we have about objects is what he calls the uncanny. So both, the idea that these are both familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. So you think you know what they're for, but you actually don't. Now, I'm not debating, you know, the kind of rights and wrongs of those views. What I'm trying to say is, in 19th century, there's this deep, and today, of course, 19th century onwards, I should say, there's this deep unease about the plethora of objects that surround you every day and your relationship to them. And people are trying to think through that particular relationship or that particular network of relationships. So one of the consequences of that is this idea of things being not what they seem to be. So the idea of mysteriousness of things. So that passage where Leroux is talking about all these objects, the fancy goods, some from Algeria, 4 egg cups, etc., from the convent, he harps on the texture of those objects and heightens their desirability that Emma can't resist, without, of course, telling us the cost, the exact cost of the production of those objects. So that those objects acquire a kind of seductive gleam, mysterious gleam for Emma that she cannot resist. That's kind of what Marx, and in a very different way Freud, are getting at. That objects are mysterious, they throw us. They surprise us to the extent that we find them irresistible in some ways, but we are also slightly uneasy about them. When we realize that our entire lives are invested into exchange of objects, we don't quite trust them. Hence, Freud is talking about the uncanny here, the view of uncanny that acquires importance in the 19th century. The second point about objects are they're spectacular, right? And this is the point Walter Benjamin makes about Paris, the capital of 19th century, where you're in the middle of the century where objects, day-to-day objects, have taken on this magical gleam because they are on display everywhere. They're display as things that you automatically assume that you must desire. So when Benjamin talks about Paris, the capital of the 19th century, he's talking about the arcades, the shopping arcades, and he's trying to understand why arcades have become the new place where people gather, even if they're not buying. And you know, we do this all the time, don't we? We window shop, right? So you go through, even if you're perennially broke, like all of us, you stop to look at them. And this interests Benjamin. He tries to understand, why do people behave like this all the time? They're not shopping, but they're looking. So there's something about the spectacular appeal of objects, in the same way that Emma finds them spectacular, that gathers our attention in. In a previous age, we might have gone to the church or a place of religious gathering or a kind of community meeting, etc., to debate our lives. Today we are going to shopping arcades, right? To, in a way, invest that same kind of emotional energy to these objects that appear to us as if always for sale. So, I mean, there are various other ways of looking at material things as well. You'll notice all three commentators here are talking about objects as commodities. There are other ways of thinking about objects. But in 18th and 19th centuries, and in our down to our own times, one of the things that happens is this uneasy feeling that people have that objects are both irresistible and there is something wrong about finding them irresistible, right? The fact that we are investing disproportionate emotional energy into these objects and we don't quite understand why that is. Why do these objects appear to us as irresistible? So this is sometimes in 19th century and onwards is usually called the dark magic. Objects become magical, the dark magic of objects. What used to be in a previous age thought of in terms of witchcraft or magic that hypnotizes you now suddenly appear to us as banal everyday things, but we still can't stop staring at them. We still can't stop forming our own relationships through them. Okay, so that's the problem that the novel and indeed 19th century thinkers are trying to analyze. So what I want to do over the next 15 minutes really is give you three actions that key characters in the novels indulge in. The first is eating, the second is dressing, and the third is reading. All three actions obviously involve intimate relationship between characters and objects, food, dress, and books. And in all three cases, they become a kind of motif in the novel form from this time onwards till our contemporary times, right? And all three sites or all three actions, or the representation of these actions, tell us something key about the characters to who conduct these actions. So first, eating. And this is Emma Bovary when she eats what turns out to be arsenic, and she knows this. So the key turned in the lock, and she went straight to the third shelf. So truly did her memory serve her. She lifted down the blue jar, pulled out the stopper, rummaged inside her hand, and withdrew it filled with a white powder. This she began to eat on the spot with the consequences that we know will happen later, which turn more and more gruesome as the novel advances. The second scene is also one of eating, but again, structured differently. This happens early on in Great Expectations. This is Magwitch, whose name we don't know yet, trying to really freak Pip out, right? And this is what he says. There's a young man hid with me. Remember, Pip has stumbled onto Magwitch, who's hiding in the swamps, in the fence. With that young man, and in comparison with that young man, I am an angel. I'm an angel. That young man hears the words I speak. That young man has a secret way peculiar to himself of getting at a boy, at his heart, at his liver. So he says, if you don't bring me food, I'll unleash this young man who'll peck away at your liver and heart and etc. Pip is thoroughly scared. Obviously, he comes back the next day with all the food that he's managed to get, and this is the scene we get. He was gobbling mincemeat, meat bone, bread, cheese, pork pie all at once. I'd often watched a large dog of ours eating his food, and I now noticed a decided similarity between the dog's way of eating and the man's. The man took a sharp, sudden bite. The man took strong, sharp, sudden bites, just like the dog. He swallowed, or rather snapped up, etc., while we ate, as if he thought there was danger in every direction. Now, what is going on here? One of the things that's going on here in the Great Expectation passage is, of course, the early relationship, the early connotation of the relationship between Magwitch and Pip is being established. At this point in time, Pip doesn't know it, but his act of bringing food to Magwitch will ultimately lead to Magwitch sponsoring his gentlemanly career, and Pip has no way of knowing this. So what we're seeing here is a formation of a debt exchange, an indebtedness. But crucially, it's not a monetary one, okay? Food, that elemental object in everyday life, is being exchanged at this point in time, which results in a future exchange or future donation of wealth to one of the parties here. So what we are getting here is the bedrock of a non-monetized relationship between Pip and Magwitch. One is gifting the other food. We don't know, he doesn't know it's gifting, he's being coerced at the moment. But it secures, in some measure, his own future as a gentleman. Very different thing happens in Emma Bovary. She too is gorging herself like Magwitch is at this point in time. But what is she gorging on? Arsenic. And this is going to lead to a long, drawn out, incredibly painful death. But it is a death that in some ways obeys the logic of a monetized indebted relationship in the book. It is a parallel with her consumption of other objects that LaRue gradually entraps her with. The logical end of that, when she can't pay back anymore, is suicide. I don't mean to suggest that she only commits suicide because she's in debt, but the entire mindset of this character, of Emma, is tied to a logic of material consumption that is an end in itself. And at the end of it lies this suicidal gorging that gradually takes over her body to the extent that in the end she laughs. Remember that last scene when she wakes up, she laughs at the idea of this hideously deformed beggar who's singing outside, who we've seen before, whom she now recognizes as her twin, because that is the state of bodily decay she herself has resulted. She herself has ended with as a result of her gorging. So a very different, both scenes offer us characters who are gorging themselves, but they have very different results. So one of the things that the novel asks us to do by paying detailed attention to the relationship between food and characters is what kind of exchange is taking place here. In the case of one, it leads to a relatively more humane relationship between Magwitch and Pip. In the case of another, Emma Bovary is the culmination of the logic of rampant consumption that Emma has let herself fallen into for, you know, strong and understandable reasons for which we'll go into later. The second scene is one of dressing. And this is Emma with Leon in one of their adulterous encounters in Rouen. She even spoke of my slippers. This is Emma looking, admiring her own slippers. There had been a present from Leon in response to one of her sudden whims. Note the emphasis on my slippers. Nothing at this point in Emma is actually hers. She has kidded herself into thinking that she owns these things. Actually, it may be that these things own her. They were of pink satin trimmed with swan's down. He savored for the, and this is then the perspective switches and we get Leon looking at Emma. He savored for the first time the indescribable delicacy of feminine elegance. Never before had he come across such a grace of language, such quietness in dress, such pose as of a weary dove. Pose as of a weary dove. He recognizes that Emma is putting on a show for him, this affected pose of the world-weary woman, that makes her more attractive to Leon because he's already cast Emma in a role. What is that role? Was she not a woman of the world and a married woman? The perfection, in short, of what a mistress should be. So what you get here is, again, the novel's intense gaze on material of Emma's dress, with a couple of effects. First, it heightens the irony of Emma thinking that she owns these things, where in reality none of these things are hers, obviously. The second is it gives us the idea of Emma performing the character of a woman of the world, a married woman, etc., that makes her desirable to Leon. But we know that desire is already problematic in Madame Bovary because the more Emma plays these roles according to which she thinks, you know, the more she makes herself desirable, in other words, the more she plunges into that dark realm of indebtedness and used objects. In the end, what happens to her is exactly what happens to objects that have outlived their use. She's a mistress at the moment, but as we know with Rodolphe and Leon, they'll both tire of her in the end. Her novelty will wear off, just as the novelty of goods wear off. So the dress that we see there signals this kind of really existential lack in Emma at the moment. In contrast, look what happens in Great Expectations. This too is a description of rich dresses, but this time Miss Havisham is wearing them and the young Pip is looking at her. She was dressed in rich materials, satins and lace and silks, all of white. Her shoes were white, etc. So there's a long description of white rich dress. But I saw that everything within my view which ought to be white, so there's a kind of double glance here. Pip, at the first glance, thinks that this is a beautiful woman dressed in a bridal dress, had been white a long time ago and had lost its luster and was faded and yellow. I saw that the bride within the bridal dress had withered like the dress and like the flowers and had no brightness left but the brightness of her sunken eyes. This is exactly the glance that we don't get of Emma in her rich dress, etc. What we get here is the dress that signifies Miss Havisham's performance as what she is, i.e. the eternal bride, but at the same time it reveals the hollowness of that performance, what she really is, the skeleton, etc. With Emma, we never get that glimpse until the very end when her body decays, encased in this beautiful cloth, but to the extent that when Charles moves the veil from her face, in the end, arsenic has ravaged her face to the extent that she screams so loudly that he wakes up people inside. Right till that end, we don't get that duality between what she is and what the clothes signify. Whereas, this is very early on, Pip is still a child, but he already, because he's narrating it retrospectively, he already thinks he sees what Miss Havisham actually is and what she's trying to perform. That duality between the outward appearance and the inner woman is already visible to Pip. So dress can often perform the way people dress, the what they derive from the meanings of those dresses can often change from novel to novel, right? In Great Expectations, Pip is already, although he has to learn a lot, his retrospective narration already tells us that he will have successfully separated appearance from reality. Whereas Emma, because we don't have this first-personal narrator who's growing in knowledge as the novel goes on, in Emma, what we have here is this sense of Emma's total absorption in the roles that she's performing. Till the end, when she realizes the hollowness of that role and self-destructs. So if dresses tell us what people think of themselves and what other people think of themselves, it's not necessarily all along one plane. That dresses can signify different things, and that's something that various novels will play with as we move through the texts. Finally, the idea of an idea of consumption that is related to eating and dressing, but appears to be of a different order to us, that is to say, consuming books or reading. This is a scene in Great Expectations when Pip is loitering about in the high street. Mr. Pumblechook nabs him and drags him inside and makes him read the sensational case of this criminal, George Barnwell, and makes him act out what has happened to him. So this is very cheap literature. This is what used to be called the penny dreadfuls, i.e. cheap criminal literature that is mass marketed for everyone's reading. Now, Mr. Pumblechook has grabbed him. Pip has acted it. And for a second, look at the effect this kind of reading has, right at the end of that extract. Even after I was happily hanged, because Pip is playing the role of the criminal here, so he's been dragged into Mr. Wopsle's parlor, and Wopsle had closed the book. Pumblechook sat staring at me, shaking his head, saying, "Take warning, boy, take warning." So they've basically all been bullying Pip, as they want to do. They've made him read this cheap thriller and act out the part of the criminal. But paradoxically, for the moment, it appears to Pip they really think of him as a criminal. Take warning. This is what's going to happen to you. And this gets lodged in Pip's head, because immediately what follows this is the news that his sister has been attacked and is probably lying dying. Now, with his head full of what the criminal role, well, the role of the criminal that he's just played, Pip thinks that he himself is to blame. He assumes the guilt of Orlick's attack on on his sister, because that is the power of momentary, however, the power of reading that we are asked to believe. That even this very cheap literature, for the moment, takes you out of yourself till you actually convince that you are the criminal in the reading. A different kind of reading in Madame Bovary, but with the same if powerful effect nonetheless. She surrendered to the magic of Corelle, a magazine devoted to women's interests and of the sylphs de Salon. She devoured the accounts of the first night's race meetings and balls, not missing a single word. She pored over the description of the furniture and the works of Eugène Sue. She read Balzac and George Sand, seeking in their pages satisfaction by proxy. And that's the kind of key description of Emma, isn't it? Satisfaction by proxy, because satisfaction can never arrive unmediated in her life. She wants to get it by proxy, by reading, by shopping, by having sex with people around her. Nothing, none of those actions lead to her satisfaction, and that's the drama that the novel offers us, this endless quest for satisfaction that always eludes her. But for the moment, look at what's happening. This is again popular literature, right? Of a different kind. This is about talking about the parlors and the first night. This is in effect the 19th century version of Hello magazine that she's reading, right? So, but for the moment, she knows that this world is not hers. Maybe she knows this world is not real, but nonetheless, if she can get a momentary satisfaction about it. So think of what the novel is doing here. It's given us, both in case of Dickens and in case of Flaubert, in different ways, it's giving us, it's dramatizing for us the act of reading as an act of consumption, okay? And it's an act of consumption that gives you a sense of momentary disillusioned satisfaction that quickly fades. Now this, in an era when the novel itself, as the final extract tells you, James Raven's essay on the book as commodity, this in an era when the novel itself is marketed as a commodity and has triggered off all these debates about the ethics of literature as a commodity. So the novel itself is circulating. Novels like Madame Bovary and Great Expectations, obviously, that are serialized, etc., have taken over the role of mass entertainment and mass information, thereby triggering all these anxieties about what happens to literature when literature arrives in the market as consumable commodities that you're borrowing from circulating libraries, that you're buying, etc., etc. Can literature be, in fact, do the kind of noble work that it's supposed to do when it's already a commodity? What the novel does, quite mischievously in some occasions, is to model this debate within its own plot by showing characters who not only misread text, but they also consume texts for their illusory search for satisfaction. One of the things that happens, you'll see in common to Jane Austen's Emma or Gustave Flaubert's Emma, you'll see that they both, and Knightley, remember, tells, we were discussing this briefly, Knightley tells Emma that your reading has no ordering in it. You begin books and you don't finish. You have very admirable lists of reading list, but actually there's no kind of discipline in your reading. And one of the things that he teaches Emma, not consciously of course, is how to read signs properly. And Emma succeeds, and by the end of they're united. Not so in the case of Emma Bovary. She never, and in the case of Julien Sorel, remember, both of them are brought up on these romances, Napoleonic and otherwise, where they fantasize about their role as characters in those romances, etc. They've read, and they fail to achieve that in real life. Exactly the kind of charges that are being laid against the novel as a form in the age of book as a commodity. So when novels talk about reading and misreading, they're not only talking about the character's own capacity or the lack thereof of reading. They're also asking you to consider what happens when reading has become an act of consumption like shopping. Okay? What is the relationship between you and words? What is the relationship between books, the book in front of you, and yourself, given that it's a monetized relationship? You've bought the book or you've become a member of the circulating library. In other words, the act of reading has become a mass act. This is the novel in the age of mass literacy. And what it's trying to ask, or it's kind of slyly asking you is, what is the nature of the pleasure you're deriving from reading? Is it really different from the kind of pleasure that you derive from shopping? If so, why? Why do you think reading will make you a better person than going to the shopping arcades and, if not shopping, all the things that you see, at least desiring them? So what it raises is the question of, is desire for consumption, when the book itself is a consumable, is that problematic? Is this the relationship that you have with everything around you? Because we normally think, okay, you know, and this is, you know, I used to be told when I was, you know, whenever young, a long time ago, they used to be told that it's okay to steal books. It's fine because it's an ennobling act, right? Because, you know, you'll become a better person when you read the book. But never steal, never shoplift, a cassette, right? But shoplift books or steal from library, that's fine. Because ultimately you'll be a better person. The idea of reading being a better thing, right, makes you somewhat more intelligent, etc. Well, the novel models this question, that is your desire for consuming reading really of a different order than the other kinds of desire that structure your relationship in society? And that kind of metatextual reflection on its own status as a commodity is something the novel will constantly signal as being problematic throughout its life. So, when we read novels, etc., various kinds of novels, subsequently, one of the things we should pay attention to is what is the descriptive energy it is bringing to itself in regard to the objects that it's describing, and what it tells us, not just about the characters, but about us as readers who are interpreting that particular relationship between characters and things, hence, in other words, the social lives of things. Good. Off you go. We've got 5 minutes. I've got 5 minutes to run to the writer's room, so I'm sure I'll make it. So next week is reading week. There's obviously no lectures. We'll see you in week 7.